Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. We're good for about one a year. This is Ben Golver with Blazers Edge. I'm here with Kevin Pelton of Basketball Prospectus and the 2013 lottery team, Indiana Pacers. Kevin, coming off a big win last night, you got to be excited.
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to.
Are you looking for more than that?
Oh, well, you don't want to talk about the Pacers now. I see how it is.
I celebrated with a Joey Crawford block dance.
See, that was absolutely ridiculous. Don't you think he should be fined for that dance? I mean, I counted. He took five steps. His knees practically hit his Adam's apple when he was doing the dance. And he covered about, I think, 20-something feet. That seems to me like excessive celebration.
The NFL would fine him.
I think he should have gotten a technical foul from one of the other referees on the court as it was happening. I think he makes the block call, then he gets whistled for a technical for excessive celebration, then the game moves on. Anyway, if people didn't watch that game because they don't really care about the Lakers because they're a sub-500 team, I totally understand. All right, let's get to Blazer talk because we've got a lot going on. We haven't talked about this team. It's almost December. I can't say I've been super surprised by anything that's happened to date, but it's been interesting and it's definitely been worth a little check-in in terms of where guys are standing, compared to relative to expectations. And you did some overachievers and underachievers this week, so I thought we could talk about that a little bit. Let's start with your overachiever, Damian Lillard, and I'm actually going to have you lay out the case for why he's overachieved, and then I'm going to start to express some of my fears and concerns about his future. And then you're probably going to need to talk me off the ledge. How's that sound?
That sounds terrific. Dr. Pelton is always here for you.
Okay. So what you're saying is, compared to preseason expectations around the NBA, Damian Lillard has exceeded his projection by more than any other player. Is that right? Except for one, Andre Drummond.
Yeah, I believe Andre Drummond. Yeah.
Okay. So he's number two. Well, tell us why.
Well, all of it, again, is contingent on expectations. And I think Shaney, based on, the translations from Weber State to the NBA, had much lower expectations for Damian Lillard this season than most people, anyone who watched him play in the summer league certainly and saw him dominate that or then saw what he did again in the preseason. So by that point, there was a pretty good sense that, hey, Shaney is going to be wrong about this guy. I think that it's just a question of degree with Lillard because I thought he would be a solidly above average point guard right away. I didn't think that he would be playing at an all-star level like he has thus far.
And you probably didn't expect him to be playing 38 minutes a night either, did you?
No, I didn't expect that everyone on the Blazers starting lineup would be playing like Luol Deng minutes.
And that is the one big X factor in all this stuff. You could project even on a per minute basis what guys were going to do. And I think I was expecting, personally something like, 16 and 5 or something like that. But I was also expecting him to play, lower 30s in minutes. And if you extrapolate it out, where he's at isn't exactly, too far from maybe those expectations. But do you remember offhand what Shaney was expecting for him coming into the year?
Not in terms of per game stats. I mean, I might be able to look that up. But, generally the thought that overall he was going to be about replacement level, a little bit better than that. So obviously he's been substantially. And, I think what really is remarkable is for him to be as efficient offensively as he is for a rookie point guard in the league. If you look at, rookie point guards have been doing better, but still in terms of actually being above average as a scorer, I think in terms of efficiency, I think Kyrie Irving is the only other guy in probably the last 5 years or so that has managed that.
Yeah, no doubt. So can we start picking this apart now?
Sure.
Here's where I'm getting concerned. Okay. Well, one, obviously there's the issue of turnovers. Are we just going to assume that he's going to be a high turnover guy because he has the ball so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. His turnover rate is above average for a point guard right now, but that's not uncommon for a rookie, certainly.
Okay, so you're expecting as he develops, that's going to wane a little bit.
One of the things I've mentioned in the past is that we find that guys with high turnover rates as young players, it's actually kind of a good thing for their development because it means they're trying things. They're not, just kind of sitting in the corner like the stereotype was about Batum as a young player. But eventually those mistakes that are turning into turnovers now will start to become better decisions over time.
Okay, so now let's bring up the issue of age, right? Because he's getting I'm seeing all these comps out there. Oh, his rookie year compared to Kyrie's rookie year. His rookie year compared to this guy's rookie year. But there is this factor of, you know, if he had gone one and done like all those other guys, he'd be significantly younger. And the difference between a 19-year-old point guard and a 22-year-old point guard is pretty substantial, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I started to look at this. It's going to be a column at some point on Basketball Prospectus for sure. Basically, what I think, you know, it's a question of ceiling. So if Kyrie Irving does what he does as a 19-year-old rookie, then his ceiling is, you know, one of the best point guards of all time, frankly. Definitely one of the best point guards in the league. Lillard's ceiling is, you know, probably all-star. I don't see him getting any better than that, but, you know, compared to Raymond Felton and Jamal Crawford, all-star looks pretty amazing right now, I'd have to say.
It sure does. Let's get back to the issue of how good the Blazers need him to be in a second. Let's keep going through his game. So the turnovers haven't worried me too much. Obviously, they're going to be a continued issue. I think everybody's willing to give him a lot of slack considering some of these players that he's working with, considering, you know, how young he is and also the competition that he's faced. I mean, he's had all sorts of tough matchups, whether it's, you know, a really smart, quick-hands guy like Chris Paul, whether it's a huge physical guy like Deron Williams who really got into him. I mean, he's seen a lot already. And when he's going against your sort of, you know, average or below point guards, he already looks like he's, you know, expecting to win those matchups. Not every night. Obviously, he didn't shoot very well against the Detroit Pistons and Brandon Knight, who doesn't have the greatest efficiency numbers at all. But he goes into those matchups, I think, with the mentality of he already feels established above those guys. And you don't see that very often for a rookie.
No, I think that's a good way to put it. And, you know, the thing that has stood out from day one is just his poise, his you know, level of execution, things like that, that are uncommon for a rookie point guard in this league.
Okay, now here's some of my concerns. He's only shooting 44% from the field, even though he's shooting 40% from three, and he's taken six threes a game, right? So a couple problems with that. Number one, and not a problem, is the fact that he's shooting 40% from three-point. That's awesome. But it's a lot of reliance on the three-point shot. When it's not there, he's putting his team behind the eight ball. Number two, you know, is he becoming too much of a spot-up guy already, or has he just simply not figured out other ways to score, and maybe that's going to develop down the road because, you know, frankly, he's not going to be an above-the-rim player. He's not a Russell Westbrook in terms of being able to leap out of the gym. He could finish around the rim on occasion. He's got some pretty nifty layups to his resume, but he also has a lot of misses, you know, in that range. And then he hasn't shown a ton anywhere else in terms of, you know, shot chart-wise. In terms of really bankable shooting and go-to moves, so to speak. So I'm a little bit worried that, okay, teams are going to continue to pressure his three-point shooting, force him off the line, ask him to do more, and maybe he hasn't shown yet the capability to do that.
You know, I feel like what stands out to me about watching Lillard is not so much the catch-and-shoot, is when he's shooting off the dribble. If teams go under him on the pick-and-roll, he's just pulling up and making that shot. And that's been responsible for a lot of his success so far. You know, as teams adjust that and they don't go under and they start to play the pick and roll differently, that's where I think he's going to have to show the ability to get into the lane more frequently than he has.
Okay, and then the other issue related to that is he's averaging, you know, 3.8 free throws or 3.9 free throw attempts per game in basically 37 minutes a night. Given how much he handles the ball, you know, given the fact that they do ask him to create a lot, especially late in games, they've already, you know, shown a lot of trust in him to take his man one-on-one. Don't you think we need to see a slightly better ratio of, say, you know, rather than six three-pointers and four free throws a game, it looks a little bit different?
No, I necessarily mind him taking six three-pointers a game since those are such efficient shots, but without question he has to start getting the free throw line more often. You know, I think that sometimes for a young player, that can be a learned skill as much as anything else. You know, we saw that with Derrick Rose early in his career in Chicago. That was one of the criticisms, was that he was trying to make the acrobatic shot and wasn't ever getting to the free throw line enough, and that was holding his efficiency back, and he sort of improved at it after he heard that criticism and now gets to the free throw line all the time.
Okay, so now let's switch gears and look at the defense issues. I mean, he kind of got called out by Zach Lowe a little bit. You know, basically saying he's got a lot of work to do. I think most people would agree with that. That's one of those things that's really easy to write off as a rookie thing, right? You know, Chris Paul schools you, leaves you, you know, spun around backwards, and he's basically walking into the paint. You know, Deron Williams bullies you a little bit. Hey, it's your first time through. How much can you reasonably expect a guy at 22 to improve defensively over the course of his rookie deal, say, towards years 3 and 4? Or is this going to be a guy who just succeeds based on being better, are significantly better than average on offense and just tries to get by on defense, especially when you have to play him this many minutes a night?
Well, I would say that there are two factors here. Number one, I think maybe we're seeing that adjustment from the playing in the WAC a little bit more at the defensive end of the floor, or the Big Sky, not the WAC, I don't know. Where, you know, he wasn't, not only wasn't dealing with guys like Chris Paul, but the other thing is the college game is so much less dependent on the pick and roll, especially at that level, that he's probably not used to managing his way through picks, and I think that's going to be a lot of his improvement if he gains experience with that. But I think the other factor here is, you know, Lillard is a smaller guy. That's one of the knocks on him maybe going into the draft. He's very physical, but not long arms. And I increasingly, I believe that the most important factor in point guard defense is size, because of the fact that it gives you the ability to A, switch the pick and roll, and B, contest shots even after you're beaten. So Lillard's never going to be able to fix that.
That's true. And, like, you know, kind of going along with that, you know, size, and you mean wingspan as well. I mean, are we kind of seeing some of that as an important, you know, development? It's like if you've got those long arms. I guess Bledsoe's the guy who comes to mind recently in terms of guys getting credit for having a freakish wingspan and being able to do certain things defensively. But that's a big deal. And Blazers fans know that going all the way back to the days of, you know, Jared Bayless and all the flack he would take for his short arms. But – I mean, are you throwing that in there, too, when you're talking about size?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's a factor that can – players can play bigger or smaller than their actual listed size because of wingspan.
Gotcha. All right. Well, you've calmed me a little bit. I guess my biggest concern when I was looking at him is, you know, basically he's shooting so well from outside that that could waver. I mean, there's going to be fluctuations there. And then I want to see the bankable stuff elsewhere offensively to make me feel really sold. With that said – I mean, it is obviously nitpicking here. I mean, he's had a sensational start. He's shown the ability to handle all the minutes that Stotts is playing him, which is a huge thing for, you know, a lot of rookies don't even get that opportunity. And, you know, it's not like they're a team that wins 2 out of every 10 games. I mean, they put up a reasonable record. He's been in some very big late-game scenarios. He's played well and very calm in those scenarios. So I think there's a lot to like. But certainly there's room for improvement, and it's going to be fun to track here. I think from basically, you know, the start of December through the end of the season, I mean, it's by far the number one thing that I'm going to be keeping my eye on is where does he go? You know, where does he go from now until April? What can he add to his game that he hasn't shown over these first couple of weeks? I think that's the biggest storyline the Blazers have going.
He's the best reason to watch the Blazers right now, without question. I just ran some quick numbers if I can try to further assuage your fears. If he was shooting 35% from three, his win percentage would be about 0.570 instead of where it actually is, 0.614. So that wouldn't be all-star level, but again, still solidly above average. You know, solid starting point guard is a rookie. You know, I think that there's some room to decline in terms of his three-point shooting and still be very good.
Very interesting. That brings us back to the topic we left for a second earlier, which is how good do the Blazers need him to be? I mean, we can agree at this point, LaMarcus Aldridge is gone in 2 years, right? I mean, they're going to move him. It just seems like, and I'm not trying to throw, you know, a fire into a theater, whatever that phrase is, but doesn't this first month have, like, every possible indication that he's mailing the season in, the Blazers are looking for ways to kind of diversify so they're not so reliant upon him, and then, you know, the early talk about, oh, we're going to be very upfront with the situation, and we're not going to trade him for a couple years and all that. Doesn't that all kind of seem like it's laying the groundwork towards an inevitable split that tries to happen on good terms, or am I just imagining all of this?
I don't think you're imagining it. I think you're utilizing it so that you can throw a fire into a crowded theater, which
oh, no.
A brand new expression that has never been used before, which so I'm glad we could break ground here on the Wingcast. to me, what's transpired so far this season is, you know, encouraging in terms of keeping LaMarcus Aldridge. If your big concern is, oh, he's going to want to bolt for a different place because of the fact that the Blazers aren't good enough, well, you know, right now they're not that far from 500 with one of the worst benches that has ever been put together in NBA history. And sometimes one of the best things for a team is to have a huge weakness like that, because it's a lot easier to upgrade than if you've got 8 solid guys.
Okay, well, so explain to me how they're using him and how that's going to help going forward. I mean, the numbers are absolutely astonishing. You've seen the number of long twos he's taking per game, right? It's nearly double anybody else in the entire league. I mean, this guy is so far of an outlier, it's almost like a disgrace to the word outlier. Like, he's just all the way out there by himself completely, and he's not just the quote-unquote old LaMarcus Aldridge where he's maybe taking, you know, a few too many. This is clearly a systematic thing between Stotts, between him, but they're putting him in that situation, which is not a great situation for any player to be in. And, you know, he's hitting a solid but not spectacular number of them. And, you know, his efficiency is just going in the tubes. I mean, shouldn't we be a little bit concerned about that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, so maybe Terry Stotts is trying to turn him into Dirk Nowitzki 2.0. But, you know, I don't think that LaMarcus Aldridge is, like, sitting there saying, I want to get in the post so much more. And Terry Stotts is like, no, stay out on the perimeter. I have a hard time imagining that conversation taking place.
I hear you, but Dirk's peak levels, right? He's always a 48% or better shooter. You know what I mean? Like, he's always hitting, and he's got the 3-point range to kind of supplement, you know, what he's doing. Aldridge doesn't have that. Clearly, Aldridge's bankable stuff was down there on the block when he was at his best, making those two pushes to try to make All-Star teams. Unfortunately, that's kind of when he's played his best basketball. Has been in the, you know, the month before the coaches decide who gets to be an All-Star reserve these last two seasons. Every time he's done that, his rebounding numbers have gone up and his, you know, at-rim attempts or in-the-paint attempts have gone up significantly. We just haven't seen that for the first month. The other things I'm worried about is, you know, he said he lost a step. I'm not going to take that, you know, too seriously because he's, you know, 27. I think he's just kind of saying that. But, you know, this back issue he's had recently, the fact that he's coming off a hip surgery, he said he was 100%. But now that they're putting him in this different role, which is so much more oriented around the perimeter, he's rebounding, you know, at a very low rate compared to, you know, recent seasons after trying to, you know, say he was going to be a 10-rebound a guy kind of player. I mean, all these things seem like early warning signs for something that's not a good situation to develop. You know, this doesn't seem like this is a guy who's embracing the number one role. Also, the fact that he's already been, kind of cast aside in late-game situations. They're letting Damian, they're letting Nick have the ball in a lot of those situations. I mean, all of it seems to me, it's just fishy. It doesn't feel right. This is not exactly what we expected coming into the season when they're talking about how they don't need to do a full rebuild because they've got an all-star on the roster that they're going to build around. This team doesn't really seem like it's built around LaMarcus anymore, and it happened immediately. It took less than a month.
You know, I think the other – well, I think that they were building around LaMarcus, clearly, because, I mean, you look at the effort to get a center this year with Myers Leonard and then Roy Hibbert in free agency. That's both bowing to the fact that Aldridge has always been like, you know, I want to play power forward. I don't want to be a center. But I think that there may have been a miscalculation there that, you know, Aldridge is better off next to a bigger guy because, you know, it's different than Marcus Camby, who was a guy who was very most comfortable in the high post, worked that high-low with Aldridge last year very effectively. That guy doesn't exist on the roster right now. You know, Joel Freeland, in theory, I think, could become that player, but he hasn't been able to get on the court. So right now you've got him and Hixon are operating in a lot of the same spaces, and J.J. Hixon is the guy who's suddenly cleaning the glass at the defensive end in a manner that's completely out of line with the rest of his career. And so how much does that explain LaMarcus's rebounding numbers being down?
That's a very interesting factor. Do you think Hixon's going to make it through the season here?
I would be surprised if he agreed to a trade because I don't know why he'd want to give up his bird rights unless he thought that there was no chance of the Blazers signing him or even sending him somewhere in a signing trade.
I mean, do you see – I don't know if I see him as a long-term piece on a winner for the Blazers. I mean, I can see him as like a fourth – he seems kind of like the kind of player that a playoff team would rent as like a fourth or a fifth big, add to their rotation. Maybe they give the Blazers like a pick and an expiring contract back. And that's kind of how it goes down to the trade deadline. Am I crazy?
Right now, I think he's overqualified for that. I mean, he's
playing a really good clip. Oh, don't buy into the J.J. Hixon stuff.
He's still bad defensively, but he's gotten better in that regard when I've watched him play. You know, he seems...
Okay. J.J. Hixon is just the classic, you know, score two, give up three kind of player. You can't buy into what he's doing, Kevin. Come on. You got to have some plus-minus or some on-court, off-court stats to give you some sort of a sense of perspective, right?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. It's the Portland starting lineup is outscoring opponents by 0.05 points per – I think it's 5 points per 100 possessions. That's what it is. So that lineup has been a very good lineup. That's not the issue. It's whenever any of those guys aren't on the floor.
Yeah, I think you could plug. I think you could take him out, and it's not going to make a huge difference. I mean, the thing about him is, okay, he's supposed to be a center. The other night, he has an unforced jump pass turnover on the perimeter, which he compounds by hustling back on defense to commit a completely unnecessary and one foul in transition. And it's so many mistakes per second, like it broke my calculator. And just guys like that, he can't be your starting player. He can't be anything more than a seventh or eighth guy on a team. You know what I mean? He can be your energy, hustle, rebounder, high rebounds per minute guy off the bench for a team that's trying to make a playoff push. But past that, I think he's underqualified, not overqualified.
I think he's at least a third big in this league. But let's answer the real question here: who is the big man who should be alongside LaMarcus Aldridge to maximize his value?
Well, I think that your point on that is very well taken, and honestly, it reminds me a lot of this whole Pau Gasol Dwight Howard thing, because everybody seems to agree that Pau Gasol's best days are behind him, right? But were his best days also almost perfectly in line with when he was playing with Lamar Odom and they had like that great 4-5 chemistry where he was the low post guy and able to do as much as possible around the rim, and Odom was the versatile guy where maybe he didn't quite ever find the right balance with Bynum, and then with Howard, he's like been totally supplanted by Howard, and now, you know, Pau Gasol is basically an 18-foot jump shooter, and you know, he trips all over himself, and sure, he's injured, I understand that, but he kind of seems like he has some of the same issues going on with LaMarcus that you're describing. And, you know, I think if you've got a power forward who can score at the rim, you want him around the rim a lot more than either one of those guys are playing at the rim, and it's tough. I don't know if you have to stagger your rotation so you don't play the two bigs together as much or whatever, but I'm not sure that you do have that big on the Blazers roster at this point that that can really stretch the floor and do the kinds of things you need so that LaMarcus can be down low. And that could have been a miscalculation for sure. The other interesting thing, the what-if scenario, is, okay, what happens if they had brought in Roy Hibbert? Then what does Aldridge become, you know? I mean, on paper, everybody thought that would be a really interesting 3-4-5 lineup and potentially a full starting lineup when you've got, you know, Lillard, Matthews, Batum, Aldridge, and Hibbert. You got two all-star bigs. All of a sudden, you're going to be pretty good. But would that have even worked?
I know, it's an interesting question. I mean, it's a very specific fit of guy that we're talking about who both is big enough to defend the opposing center because Aldridge doesn't want to do that and is valuable offensively when he's away from the basket. Now, you know, it's not to say that you need one guy to be a stretch player in any given lineup or that you can't have Aldridge in the post and another big guy who's, you know, lurking on the weak side for offensive rebounds or something like that. I mean, there are teams that make that work. You know, the Clippers with Griffin and DeAndre Jordan are an example of someone like that. But it definitely is figuring out how to maximize Aldridge's challenge right now.
Yeah, and I don't like the Griffin-DeAndre Jordan combination either, although I like it a little bit more now that Griffin's added a little bit of a mid-range jumper this season. But that doesn't work for me either, and I think late in games that's going to be their Achilles heel. I don't see them advancing in the playoffs very far because I'm not sure if they can get all their scores on the court at the same time and stay big, and then, you know, DeAndre Jordan's foul trouble and all that. But, yeah, I think it's like this new paradox in the NBA is can you actually play two bigs at the same time or do you have to choose? And then, you know, that puts the Blazers in an interesting spot. Well, let's talk about Myers Leonard for a second since we're talking about bigs. I mean, there's a better chance Myers Leonard's going to be a Blazer in 3 years than there is LaMarcus Aldridge at this point. What has he shown you, or what's your first impression of how he's played?
You know, I don't think really too surprising in terms of what I expected from him right now. You know, he's got the size and he's got the skill. The question is, it's the strength and kind of the experience. His rebounding rate right now is, I think ghastly might be the best way to put it. It's not that far from where Aldridge is, but you know, it's gotta be better than it has been. So maybe he's affected by Hickson as well. It's gotta be better than it has been, but offensively, you know, he definitely shows you that he's got tremendous touch, good at the free throw line, things like that, you know, project down the road.
Yeah, it took him a while to find his mid-range jumper. What I liked about how he handled that situation is that we were giving him pretty endless crap about the fact that he hadn't made a shot outside of 2 feet for like the first 9 games. And he had been talking so much for like a month coming into preseason. Oh, I can make 15 jumpers in a row, blah, blah, blah. He's saying this over and over and over again. But what I loved about how he handled it was that he was so self-effacing once he finally made his first jumper. And he was like, he just completely admitted. He's like, yeah, you know what? I did talk myself up. I did say I could make a lot of jumpers. And guess what? I didn't make any for the first 9 games. But now I did. Now I'm feeling better, and I'm going to go forward with it. It was great. He handled it perfectly, especially for a young guy. And, you know, he's got a very interesting personality. I mean, he's a small-town kid. I thought the adjustment actually to the NBA would be tougher for him than it's been. He seems to be fitting in pretty well. I think he's got leadership potential down the road in terms of he's emotional in a good way when he's playing well, and I think people will be drawn to that. And, you know, he's a thoughtful kind of kid, and I think, you know, in the locker room, I think he's going to move into a veteran role as he progresses through his career very naturally. I think he's going to have a tendency to look out for younger guys because I think, you know, as a younger brother in his family, I think he had a lot of people looking out for him, especially his own brother, which he obviously idolizes. And I think he's going to be looking to pay that forward. So I think in terms of a locker room chemistry guy, I think he's going to be great. I think Lillard reminds me a lot of Brandon Roy in terms of leading by example, kind of walking quietly but carrying a big stick, so to speak. Aldridge is a big question mark to me in the leadership department. I mean, I don't know. You know, he was kind of telling. He paused for quite a while when he was asked who's his best friend on the team before he kind of said, oh, maybe it's Wesley. I mean, to me, he's just kind of off doing his own thing, and I'm not sure he's quite that linchpin that you need him to be. So I think, you know, going forward, the picks at 6 and 11 in terms of Lillard and Leonard, I think both of them so far are tracking ahead of schedule in terms of expectations. So I think, you know, Neil O'Shea is going to have that to, you know, hold above critics by the end of the season if the win-loss record does get pretty bad. I think he's going to be able to stand by both of those picks pretty strongly.
Okay, so here's the next question then is, if you do move Hickson at midseason, if he agrees to that kind of trade, is Leonard going to be ready to move into the starting lineup at that point?
Oh, yeah. No, and I think I've been thinking that's going to happen since basically media day. I mean, it seems like they're kind of using this as a carrot situation for Myers, where they don't want to give it to him on day one. They don't want to throw too much at him. But I don't see why, you know, once if it gets to a point where they're playing garbage time down the stretch, you know, say February, March, April, or maybe even just March, April, just sort of depending on, you know, how close they're able to stay in the race. I mean, keep in mind, they're one injury away right now from being absolutely horrible. And we saw it with, you know, Hickson being out one game. We saw it with Aldridge being out a game. I mean, it's a totally different team when they don't have their full starting five. So as soon as that first injury happens, you know, knock on wood that it doesn't, but injuries happen. You know, everything, it's going to be a total reassessment in terms of, you know, the ceiling for wins and losses on this team. And I think, you know, that's going to play out into down the stretch where, yeah, I think they'd be foolish not to be starting him in those games just so he can get his feet wet a little bit more, so he can face the number one guys rather than the second stringer, so he can get used to playing those kinds of rotation minutes alongside LaMarcus and with Damian. You know, to me, that kind of seems like a no-brainer. Even if you don't trade Hicks, and I would kind of expect to see a shift there in the lineup, you know, as they get towards the end of the season.
Okay, so if you feel then like you've got a starting lineup set for next season, if Leonard is capable of making that step in his development, so basically your entire focus next summer is how do you strengthen the bench?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they just don't really have a lot of pieces to trade at this point. You know, I think you can make strong argument that, you know, each one of these pieces has a higher internal value than external value. You know, I think Wesley Matthews means more to you than you're going to be able to get in trade. Nicholas Batum, given his contract, you know, probably isn't going to give back what you want if you did move him. Damian obviously is untouchable. Myers is most likely, you know, close to an untouchable status at this point. And then LaMarcus, I think, you know, it just comes down to timing on when you move those guys to get the best return. I think we've seen that. And I don't foresee him being traded this season or next season. So, yeah, I mean, to me, you're going to be addressing that bench, and they got all sorts of holes there. But let's stick with the guys people actually care about as opposed to just, you know, lambasting all these Portland reserves who are just terrible in their own individual ways. Nicholas Batum, tracking towards his contract, has he lived up to it? Has he not? Initial thoughts on Batum?
No question in my mind that he's lived up to it. You know, he was in the top five in WARP for a while there. He slipped a little bit with that. The last few games, he's struggled a bit, but, you know, the consistency is still not entirely there from him, and I don't know that that's ever going to be the way that he is going to be, just given his skill set and his personality. But on his best nights right now, he's one of the best small forwards in the league.
That's very well put. I almost feel like you hacked my email this morning because I had some French students who were doing a report on Nicolas Batum, and they were asking me various questions about whether he'd lived up to it or not, and that's almost exactly what I said. The consistency is, of course, the main issue, but I think what we are seeing is some of the intangible stuff. You know, these third-quarter runs, they're not happening by accident. I mean, he's personally generating them. He's pulling his team back from a deficit. He's saying, hey, we're not going to fold and roll over like a lot of teams do in the NBA when they're playing better teams or more veteran teams. You know, it's very common for young teams to just fold, you know, roll over and die. And I think he's done that more at home than on the road, which is going to be, you know, an area that you need to improve going forward. I mean, you need to be able to generate that kind of injury, energy and game-changing dynamic no matter where you're playing. But he clearly feeds off the Rose Garden crowd. He's looking to get them pumped up. There's a little bit of Gerald Wallace to him, I think, this season in terms of how he's been trying to egg the crowd on with some of his hustle plays, and you like to see that. Of course, the three-point shot's been great. You know, that's kind of his bread and butter. He's, I think, had mixed results in expanding his offensive game, but I do like that, you know, Stotts has definitely featured him a lot more than we've ever seen him featured before, and I don't think there's been anything you know, that's really a cause for concern. It's not like he's doing too much. He's not forcing things necessarily. He obviously took that one three-pointer, but it was a clean look at the buzzer, or not the buzzer, but, you know, last 10 seconds against the Spurs, trying for a knockout blow when he probably should have attacked off the dribble. But, you know, by and large, he's not finding himself in positions where he's overly forcing off the dribble. And he's definitely more confident. I mean, he might not be fully consistent, but he definitely has the confidence level there, at least in sort of his off-the-court demeanor of him realizing what it means to be a number two guy. That was a question mark coming into the season. You know, he was, you can kind of talk about wanting to do that, but to actually do it, I think we've seen that. So I don't think at this point yet there's any reason for regret in terms of how that thing played out. The Blazers probably wish he hadn't said some of the things he said this summer, but otherwise, you know, it's fairly smooth. They probably really wish they could go back to January and lock him up for cheaper early, which is something that we wrote about at the time, but this isn't the worst, you know, fallback scenario.
Yeah, especially because, I mean, the one upside of letting Batum go to free agency was having that smaller cap hold on the books, and then, you know, when you get your offer to Roy Hibbert matched, it ended up not mattering at all.
Yeah, I mean, that seemed like a folly, that part, but, hey, it was worth a shot. So let's talk about Joel Freeland, actually. Let's pick on one of the bench guys, because you singled him out as one of the NBA's biggest disappointments this early in the season. I think part of that, you point out sample size. I mean, it's very unlikely that he's going to be shooting 6% for the rest of his career or even another week. But what is it about, or what did, I guess, what was expected of him coming over according to the numbers? I mean, we had watched him during the Olympics, and I talked about him being a hustle player, a guy who's going to struggle to defend length and height, but a player who could really mix it up, get a lot of loose balls, rebounds, potentially, you know, do a few different things on offense, depending on how you use them. And we just haven't seen hardly any of it. I mean, he looks lost. He looks like the game's going on around him. He's not getting any offense generated at all. He really looks uncomfortable in terms of when he should shoot, when he shouldn't shoot. Clearly, there's going to be an adjustment period. But what did the numbers suggest he was going to be able to bring to the table?
You know, I think they were similar to the general conventional wisdom that he was probably a third big type, you know, a slightly below average player. But someone who could contribute on the glass, a decent offensive player, and someone who might be stretched, because I thought coming in that he would probably end up emerging as the starting center next to LaMarcus Aldridge. And so I've certainly been surprised by what's transpired in terms of his playing time, I think, more than anything else. And, you know, that's partially his performance and partially the fact that Jared Jeffries has turned out to be, I think, have a lot more than most people expected left in the tank.
Yeah, Jared Jeffries has been great. Do you like him in the late-game lineups where they put him at the five if they're protecting a lead? I mean, to me, that's a great move, and I want to see that every single time. It's like I never want to see Hickson or Leonard in the game with the game on the line if the Blazers have, like, a two-possession lead. I want it to be Jeffries and Aldridge because I assume – maybe I'm getting a little Nate McMillan, but I assume that's the lowest-risk combo. You know what I mean?
It's a little bit of a concern on the defensive glass with those two guys together, but he's certainly a phenomenal instinctual defender, and, you know, I totally understand why Mike D'Antoni liked him so much back in New York.
Yeah, he's been interesting. Any of the other bench guys, I mean, are you a big Will Barton guy? You know, there's online movements. They want more playing time for Will, and I guess I'm kind of the same opinion as Dale on some of this stuff, where it's like there's going to be plenty of time for all that, allow it to unfold. But I totally hear the voices who say Sasha Pavlovich is pointless, just play Barton and roll with it.
Yeah, I mean, I probably would say that would be my opinion. I don't think it's going to make or break Will Barton's career, and it's certainly not going to make or break the season, which you do there. But if given the choice, I would probably be playing him. You know, I liked him a lot in the draft and saw that kind of thing that we expected from him finally at Detroit.
Yeah, for sure. All right, any final thoughts you want to wrap up, anything you need to plug? Oh, you've got a book. Oh, we should have mentioned that at the top. Okay, so we've got a book to give away. I'll mention this in the post. How do we want to give away the book this year? Do we want to make people jump through hoops, or do we want to have you ask a trivia question and somebody answers it by email, or what do you want to do?
I don't know. Should we have, like, a trivia question from within the book, like something like that?
Oh, yeah, that sounds, like, really good. So how are they going to know the answer if they don't actually have the book yet, though, Kevin?
Well, they'll have to guess the answer, I think.
Okay, they're going to have to guess the answer. All right, give your favorite little nugget in the form of a question, and then we'll open it up to the readers. And then
you may have to fill some time here while I look through the Portland chapter and see if there's something good in here that I can use as a trivia question.
So the book we're talking about is Pro Basketball Prospectus 2012-13, and this year, you know, Kevin has had a history of really not being super respectful of me in the book. Everyone surely remembers and could not forget when he hyphenated my name in the acknowledgement section, which was one of the biggest slap in the faces I've ever seen. I mean, to have half my name on one line, half my name on the next was just absolutely ridiculous. And I complained about it for almost 3 months straight to him, to the point where he was about to get a new phone number. Well, this year he decided that I wasn't capable of handling the Inside the Blogosphere section of the Portland Trail Blazers chapter. So he actually farmed it out and has multiple Blazers takes. Now, he did a really good job in picking the other Blazers take. Of course, that'd be Casey Holdall of Blazers.com. And he's, you know, very ingrained with the team, travels with them, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I understand the decision. But, Kevin, that really just felt like a second slap in the face to me. I mean, that's been my spot. I've held that down. I realize I don't submit my chapter to you sometimes until weeks after the deadline when you actually have the printing presses already rolling. But – come on, man. You gotta do me a little bit better than that.
You know, the thing is, it's really a team situation where two people can cover that spot better than just one can. So,
come on.
I think that's the important thing, is to get that kind of double-pronged approach.
Look, make it more sense. I don't care if you trade for Andre Miller, okay? I still want all of my shots, and I still want the ball in my hands, and I want Steve Blake playing next to me, okay?
Let's make this a trivia question after I've looked around a bit. There's not a really particularly great nugget, but let's just have people guess who they think was fourth on the Blazers in projected warp in Shaney. Is that sufficiently obscure?
That is ridiculous. Okay, so just to recap. You win a free copy of the book if you email me, benjamin.golliver@gmail.com or blazersedge@gmail.com, with the answer to the question, who had the fourth highest warp projected on the Blazers roster this season. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that covers it.
All right, Kevin, we'll probably check back in a few months or years, but good to talk to you. I think overall this was a pretty optimistic podcast, wouldn't you say? I mean, for a team that's below 500 in the middle of a tough road trip, I think we gave people reason for hope. Although I did try to trade Aldridge there in the middle of it, so people could just kind of skim over that part. But other than that, it's pretty optimistic.
I think my portion where I talked to you off the ledge about Lillard was pretty optimistic. But, you know, really the thing is wins and losses this season are almost entirely irrelevant, if not counterproductive in terms of hurting the draft pick. You know, it's all about what these young guys show and what we can expect next year and 2 years down the road.
Very well said. All right, I'm glad we did this. I feel better already. All right, KP, have a good week. Those hurt, now here come Big K. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup, for you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot, the best rap deal of all time next to Snoop.
Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, my own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clack game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment, kill them.